It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden has already reversed some policies from the Trump administration, but import tariffs on steel, aluminum, and other goods remain in place. We'll find out what signals the Biden administration is sending on trade and what questions it's facing in the months and years ahead. First, Republican state lawmakers across the country are trying to tighten up their state's voting rules. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, there have been more than 100 bills in 28 states. More than a third of them include limits on mail-in ballots. Others deal with strengthening voter ID requirements and registration, as well as making it easier to remove people from voter rolls. They're not just advancing in traditionally red states, but also ones that voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and flipped for Joe Biden in 2020. The push comes after the November election, which had the highest percentage turnout nationwide in modern times. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much confidence do you have in Wisconsin's elections? Has voting become a little too easy, do you think, or should it be made easier? How do you feel about the notion of voting by mail? Are there changes you'd like to see to Wisconsin election laws? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David Schultz is a professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. His areas of expertise include election law. David, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
What, David, do you see driving these pushes for changes in election law at the state level, mostly coming here from Republicans?
Well, I think what it is in some sense is what I'm going to call sort of a push for what's called sort of the second great disenfranchisement in American history. And what I mean by that is that if we think about the first great disenfranchisement occurring after the Civil War, after Reconstruction ended, here we're sort of seeing the same thing. And it really started somewhere in the 1990s, or maybe after Florida 2000 and the 2000 election, where there developed a partisan split over voting rights, where the Democrats still want to be able to expand the electorate, still want to make it easier for people to be able to vote. And Republicans are operating with a couple of premises. One, they're still operating with a premise that there is widespread voter fraud in the United States, and therefore we need to crack down on that fraud. And then I think the second premise that they're arguing here is that in some sense that voting has become too easy, that even though voting is supposed to be a fundamental right, they're arguing that we've just made it way too easy and therefore risking even more the possibilities of increased voter fraud in our political system.
Well, let's look at either side of that equation. Concerns that there is, on a significant scale, voter fraud. A lot of talk about that, of course, after November's election. What do we know about fraud in voting in the United States?
Well, what we know about it is not just in terms of what's happened in the court cases since 2020, but if we go back over about a 20-year period, and what we know during a 20-year period, if we look at numerous studies, the Brennan Center has done some. We look at, for example, the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism did a massive study many years ago, that the significance of widespread voter fraud in the United States is really non-existent. The way I sometimes describe the state of voter fraud in America, and this is true in terms of the percentages here, many of us have a better chance of buying a Powerball ticket and winning the Powerball than showing that widespread voter fraud is a problem in the United States. We had numerous studies that spoke to that before 2020. And since the 2020 election, there were approximately 60 lawsuits brought by Donald Trump or his associates seeking to argue that there was widespread voter fraud and therefore we needed to overturn the elections in several states, including Wisconsin. And the courts, again, over 60 cases with state level, federal level, judges appointed by Trump, non-Trump, all reach the same thing, that there is no widespread voter fraud in the United States. And then if we also look at the fact that we had recounts in several states after 2020, that yet again confirmed that there isn't this voting machine errors, there isn't sort of rigs in our system, things match up. And as Americans, we ought to be incredibly proud by the fact that especially during a pandemic and one of the most taxing times in our lifetime, that our elections largely produced reliable results. But having said that, the Republicans many Republicans still are operating under this belief that there is widespread voter fraud. And I know many people want to argue that the claim of voter fraud is merely a facade for what? For an effort to try to disenfranchise voters or to try to rig the elections so that they'll be more favorable to Republicans.
Talking to David Schultz, political scientist at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, looking at efforts in a number of states by Republican-led legislatures to tighten up voting rules. Now, on the other hand, David, we'll get into some specific changes, but, you know, tightening up voter ID requirements for mail-in votes or limiting mail-in ballots are just a couple of the changes. You know, they may make it a little more difficult, but are these really huge barriers? Are these things that are going to disenfranchise a lot of people the way, say, an old-fashioned poll tax or those discriminatory quizzes given to the Deep South back in the old days? Are they really disenfranchisement on that kind of scale?
Well, if we think of voting as sort of a cost, and what I mean by that, the more burdens that are associated with showing up to vote, the fewer people will actually cast a ballot. And the reason why I mention it is that because of the pandemic last year, where more people took advantage of absentee voting, or more people took advantage of state laws that eased voting, is partly the reason why we saw this expanded number of people who voted with a near modern record turnout. And I mention this because we dramatically expanded the turnout, but with what? Still no evidence of widespread voter fraud. That's one point. The second point is that there is some evidence that some laws, such as voter ID laws, do impact people, especially people of color. They make it difficult, and poor people, I should say, who might not have the money to be able to get what? To get the birth certificates or to get the other papers they need to verify who they are for the purposes of voting. And we also know, for example, that in most states, what your driver's license serves as an approved government ID. There are many people in the United States, including the elderly, including the poor, who don't have a driver's license, and that the cost of associated with getting, in lieu of a driver's license, a government-approved ID would dissuade them from voting. So we do have fairly good evidence that the more difficult we make it to vote, the fewer people will actually cast ballots. But at the end of the day, I think we should all still recognize the fact that yes, at the end of the day, we do have to worry about the integrity and the security of our elections and have mechanisms in place to protect against fraud. But we do have those in place already across the country, whether they are in terms of registration laws, election judges if you vote in person, and a variety of other mechanisms to try to ensure that we don't have the type of fraud that many people allege.
And when it comes to mail-in voting, and that's a subject to many of these laws, some of these laws would dial back access to mail-in voting. But, you know, isn't that kind of a recent invention? I mean, not completely, but widespread mail-in voting wasn't the norm not that long ago. Are we really losing that much if we go back to the older status quo where most of us have to vote in person?
For most places, it was usually you had to vote on the day of the election in person unless you could get an absentee ballot, and you had to basically say that you were going to be unable to make it that day because of what? You'd be out of state, you'd be in the hospital or something like that. And so traditionally, it was only allowing for absentees for excuse, but there was no right to vote absentee. And we have expanded it and made it easier and easier to vote. Over the last several election cycles, we've increased the percentage of people who've been able to vote by mail. We have several states in this country that is exclusively voting by mail. And again, what we know in those states is that the evidence of voter fraud is statistically insignificant. And so the way I'm sort of moving my argument here is that given the fact that it becomes easier for people to vote if you can allow for mail-in voting, the fact that in this election we had dramatic turnout increases because of mail-in voting, and the fact that we really have no evidence of widespread voter fraud, why would we want to go back? Why don't we say that in a country which says that the right to vote is supposed to be fundamental, shouldn't we be making it easier? Shouldn't we be enhancing the opportunities for people to be able to cast their ballots?
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in Iron River. Gary, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. Say a couple comments. One, a problem with finding voter fraud is you have to look for it. In Wisconsin, we have the absentee ballot system. You can get an absentee ballot without an ID if you certify or attest, you and your witness, that you're indefinitely confined. Way more people than normal did that this last election. And as best I can find out, nobody's ever checked to see how many of those people were indefinitely confined. And attesting or claiming that is a felony. Second, we talk about recounts, recounts. And recounts are good, and they prove that the system in terms of being able to count is fine, but they don't prove that the system of who voted is fine. So I think we have to look and then accept what we find.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call. Let's start with that second point first. A recount counts the ballots that are there. Gary's worried about the origin of those ballots and if they were legitimate in the first place, David.
Okay, I think his point is well taken because you're right that the recounts really just established that, in fact, the original count was correct. But that's important because for people who have been claiming, for example, that voting machines have been rigged, the recounts are a way of addressing it. But in terms of the issue about, let's say, absentee or mail-in voting or early voting, again, the best response to the caller is to say that, what, across the country, over 60 lawsuits were filed. And at no point was anybody able to marshal the evidence to show that there was the type of fraud that the caller asserted. I mean, this is not my opinion here. This is the fact that we went through an independent judiciaries across the country, state and federal courts. And when people were given the opportunity to say, show me the fraud, show me a situation where somebody who was ineligible to vote cast a ballot, evidence was not there. And at some point, you have to say that the absence of evidence means what? That there is no evidence. And at this point, unless somebody can affirmatively show, bring real evidence forth to prove their point, this is mere speculation that's really unfounded. And I think that becomes one of our myths in our society right now. And that myth about widespread voter fraud has been used in the past as an excuse to what? Again, to keep people from voting. And just so we understand here is that, you know, after the Civil War, it was the Democrats who were arguing widespread voter fraud, especially in the South, to prevent people from voting, the freed slaves. It was many people, including Democrats, in the late 20th centuries, who were arguing that it was widespread voter fraud to keep what people who had emigrated and become citizens in the United States. And so I mention this because at different times in history, the claim of voter fraud has taken on a different partisan banner. And right now, the partisan banner is by the Republican Party.
Thanks for that call, Gary. We're looking at a push by Republican lawmakers in many states to change election laws after the 2020 elections. David Schultz is with us, professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are there places where you'd like to see election laws a little tighter, maybe here in Wisconsin or around the country? Or do you want to see reforms and changes to make it easier for people to cast a ballot? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on a push by Republican lawmakers in many states to change election laws. David Schultz is with us, professor of political science and law at Hamline University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more efforts to tighten up voting laws, or do you think it should be easier to vote? What kind of changes in either direction would you like to see in Wisconsin or elsewhere? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go back to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Okay. Trump and other Republicans won some elections in some states. did the Republicans or Trump ever say there was voter fraud in those states they won?
Dennis, thanks for the call. David, Dennis saying the Trump campaign, I guess, fixated on states that they lost and looking for voter fraud and election changes there.
Yeah, well, there may be some Republican legislatures in those states, you know, that are making those claims, and I don't know. But no, for the most part, I did not see or have not seen anything where the Trump campaign went to court claiming that there was widespread voter fraud in, let's say, a Mississippi, Alabama, or something like that. And conversely, we didn't see Democrats go to court in the states that Trump won to also make that claim. Now, what really sort of what we're looking at is a pattern here. It was those critical swing states, you know, those Pennsylvanias, those Michigans, Wisconsins, you know, Georgia's, where the focus was. And so it was very strategic in the sense of saying that there's only fraud in states that we think we should have won.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Laura Lee now in Arizona. Laura Lee, hi.
Hi, yes. Well, until just now, I thought that this was all just a hooey by the Republicans, you know, the voter fraud. But on the other hand, gerrymandering, I think, is a form of rigged elections, if you want to call it that. And that's widespread all over the country.
Laura Lee, thanks for the call. Big issue over the next year or two, David, gerrymandering and the way we draw our political lines. Do you see momentum on changing that around the country? Do you see it as a significant problem?
Well, first off, gerrymandering is treated by the courts as a form of sort of voting rights type of issue, that if the lines are drawn in a way that don't have the proverbial one person, one vote, for example, or they're drawn in a way that are racially discriminatory, the courts have generally analyzed this through sort of the right to vote. So the caller's intuition is absolutely correct on this. Now, one of the issues that I think, and Wisconsin was the center of this, you know, last few years, was the claim all about what? Partisan gerrymandering, about lines being drawn to favor one party at the expense of the other. And the Supreme Court largely washed its hands of this issue. But even though the U.S. Supreme Court has said they're not going to address this issue, we're now seeing state courts across the country, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and others who are treating us under the state constitutions, and many states such as Arizona and Iowa have nonpartisan, redistricting commissions.
That's okay. Thanks for that call. We're talking to David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University, election law expert, looking at proposed changes in many states around the country, often by Republican legislatures, often making it a little tougher to vote or tightening up some guidelines. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hi, I worked elections for over 20 years, and it is very detail-oriented work to have cross checks to make sure things are correct. And when there's absentee ballots, for instance, at the end of the night, just on a normal day, I don't care if it's a tiny election just in your town, everything has to line up. All the numbers have to match. If it's absentee, there's a list, and we have the ballots, and it has to match the ballots. And if there's any problem, we have to look through, and the whole group is working on it. So it's not just one person doing it. If there's 5 people or 10 people, everyone is involved. Everyone has their eyes on the process. And I just wish that more people would get involved in working elections and they would understand the detail and the care that is put into doing it correctly. And they should praise the people that conduct these elections and manage them so well, because it's extraordinary.
Yordis, thanks for sharing your experience. David, your thoughts on the people actually doing this work in person?
I think this is a really important thing to understand, because what the caller is talking about here is how election judges, who are largely volunteers, or if they're paid, it's like it's minimal at best. But these election judges all across the country are really, in many ways, our front line of defense against voter fraud. And as she pointed out, there's numerous processes, rules, cross-checking that are in place. It would take a conspiracy of epic proportions to be able to rig a system. And at every precinct across the United States, we have what? It's usually bipartisan. We've got Democrat, Republican. In some states like Minnesota, we oftentimes had people who are also independents. But the point being is that if we actually looked at the mechanisms in place for how ballots are checked, how they're counted, how they're verified, we have numerous, what I'm going to call good redundancies in the system that screen out and address those fraud issues. And somehow, if we had this widespread voter fraud, I would think we would be hearing all these election judges screaming and saying, my gosh, this is going on. In fact, we're not hearing that.
Thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Jan is with us in Arena. Jan, hi.
Hi. Arena is one of the districts that was ripped out of its normal voting section by the Republicans, and we are very unhappy about it. A little corner of our district was ripped out and put up in the northern district because we were too Democratic. But anyway, that's not why I called. I called to say that I hear so many people complaining about there was so much fraud because of all the absentee ballots that came in. And they were all complaining that, well, I know that so-and-so was out and about and they're not bedridden and they're not confined to their home, so they shouldn't have been allowed to ballot by absentee. Well, we voted absentee, my husband and I. We are not bed-bound. We are not confined to the house, but we're in our 80s. And in this year of the COVID problem, we elected to vote absentee because of that, and we thought it was perfectly legal.
Jan, thanks for the call. Just briefly, it is legal. The question is over voter ID for absentee ballots. That's where the indefinitely confined thing comes in. Thanks for sharing your thoughts, though. David, just 30 seconds. What are you watching for over the next year in possible voting changes?
What I'm watching for at this point is exactly what we've been talking about here. Are there going to be efforts to try to make it more difficult to vote early? Are there going to be efforts to, say, for example, at the congressional level, where Democrats are talking about perhaps trying to establish federal uniform laws regarding voter ID, early voting, and so forth? So I guess sort of the moral of the story is we're going to see at both the state and federal level an increased partisan battle over voting rights.
David, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
David Schultz is a professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. We talked to him today about a push by state Republican lawmakers around the country to tighten up voting rules. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the early moves President Biden is making on trade and whether he's likely to reverse some of President Trump's import tariffs. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at ongoing efforts to help farmers in Wisconsin with mental health concerns. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, President Biden's executive actions of the past few weeks have tried to reverse President Trump's policies in a variety of areas, like immigration and the environment. But so far, trade policies have been largely left untouched. In one of his first decisions on trade, Biden put a tariff on steel and aluminum imports from the United Arab Emirates back in place after President Trump had lifted it on his last day in office. Whether or not tariffs on metals, agricultural goods, and other imports will stay in place is just one of the big trade questions facing the new administration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you in a line of work that felt the impact of President Trump's import duties or retaliatory tariffs from other countries? Did they help or hurt you? Where would you like to see President Biden go on these trade issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Doug Palmer is a reporter covering trade for Politico. Doug, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Has trade loomed large so far in the Biden administration, or does it look like a back burner issue so far?
Well, so far it's been fairly quiet. I mean, they're still waiting to get their nominee to be U.S. Trade Representative confirmed. And I think, once that happens, we'll begin to have more clarity about how they're going to move on some of these issues. It's definitely there in the background, and it's on a lot of people's minds, how the Biden administration is going to proceed on a number of trade fronts.
So we have that aluminum tariff on the United Arab Emirates I mentioned. It had been underplaced under President Trump until the last day in office. There had been some political exchanges with that country. Now Biden's in, tariffs back. Does that tell us much of anything about Biden's trade priorities?
You know, I don't know. People are sort of puzzled over that one. I mean, they have different views. Some people think it's kind of a one-off because the UAE, United Arab Emirates, signed, the Arab Accords with Israel and now recognizes Israel. And they also, so some people see the lifting of the tariffs as well as a big arms deal that went through on one of the last days of the Trump administration as sort of a payoff or a reward to UAE for recognizing Israel. And they sort of perceive, Biden coming in and saying, well, we want to review all of this. Let's return it to the previous status quo and figure out how we're going to go from there. But if you look at Biden's proclamation for reimposing the tariffs, I mean, he basically expresses the whole national security justification that Trump used for imposing tariffs in the first place. So it sort of makes you wonder, like, well, maybe he perceives these imports as a national security threat to the same degree that the Trump administration said that they did. If that's the case, you sort of wonder if he will be lifting the tariffs at all.
So as the trade team gets into place, what do you see as the top issues on the table for the Biden administration as they tackle trade issues?
Well, there's going to be a lot of pressure to do something on the tariffs. I mean, the European Union in particular is very anxious to see the tariff removed. And Biden has talked a lot about wanting to repair relations with Europe in order to work together on China. And it seems like if those tariffs are still in place, that's going to be, a point of friction between the two sides. And there are, the tariffs are popular with steel workers and steel companies, obviously, but a lot of other businesses in the United States would just like to see them gone. And so would farmers, for example, because, other countries have retaliated against U.S. farm products because of those tariffs. And then there's the second much bigger set of tariffs that are on China, like over $350 billion worth of goods. And of course, China has retaliated on a lot of our exports as well. Many in the business community would just like to see those lifted, but they're also sort of realistic. Like, it's very difficult for Biden just to like say, okay, I'm getting rid of the tariffs. He has to get something from China in exchange for that. Otherwise, he's going to be killed by Trump and Trump supporters for being weak on China. So he's kind of in a difficult spot on that. I think he really has to deliver something big in order to justify removing those tariffs.
Doug, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
Doug Palmer is a trade reporter with Politico. He was with us to talk about some of President Biden's first moves on trade policy and what is waiting in the wings for the new administration. Now we bring in Mark Koplovich. He's a professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He studies the international economy and trade. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
Well, Mark, a couple years ago, you were a pretty regular guest on the show with tariffs bouncing back and forth between the U.S. and China, U.S. and other trade partners. Do you see this as a priority for the Biden administration now? It seems like a lot quieter issue, but all those tariffs are still in place.
Yeah, no, I think it is an important issue. I think Doug hit on a lot of the key points there. I think it's not an important issue yet for a couple of reasons, right? So, and the first is... the push is on right now for this really large COVID relief package. And trade is an issue that divides the Democratic Party. And Biden does not want to divide the Democratic caucus right now in Congress as he's trying with slim majorities to get through the COVID relief package, right? And so, Doug was talking about, some of the rhetoric that Biden uses. Sounds very protectionist or mercantilist in the way that Donald Trump's rhetoric and policies were. And I think what you've seen over time is, you know, Biden historically has been more in the kind of pro-free trade moderate wing of the party, but the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, as you and I have talked a little bit about previously, is very protectionist in the same way that Donald Trump has been. And so there's a kind of a delicate dance right now of we sort of want to re-engage with the world and re-engage with international cooperation with our allies. And the trade war with the EU and with Canada and steel tariffs and things like that undermine those goals. But at the same time, if we kind of move back to full on free trade, then we're going to lose a lot of support from the more progressive wing of the party. So I think it's a little too soon to tell that trade is not important. But there's this kind of big policy goal right now that Biden doesn't want to rock the boat yet. And the other thing, as Doug said, Katherine Tai, the new U.S. trade representative, hasn't been confirmed yet. Right. So I think the main institutional arm of trade policy in the executive branch isn't fully up and running simply because the staff are not in place yet.
Now, one sign from the Biden administration, there was one relevant executive order, a Buy American order aimed at making sure the federal government does what it says, buy American stuff as much as possible. And I've talked to people who analyze the auto industry, for example, who talk about, you know, yeah, when you got a big customer like that, that can make a difference in the economy. What do you make of what we're hearing from President Biden? And we heard from Senator Baldwin here in Wisconsin along these same lines. Is this something that has an impact?
Yeah. So this is about government procurement, right? And buying American, you know, when the government is purchasing things to buy only or primarily American goods. I mean, this is the dance that I was referring to. So the Buy American proposal really came during the primary from Elizabeth Warren. And Biden is kind of incorporating in his policies now a lot of the policies and a lot of the rhetoric that she talked about. That, as you said, it can help certain producers. It can create jobs. And you know, a lot of the talk in the Biden administration is we're now going to have a more worker-focused, jobs-focused, manufacturing-focused trade policy. Without a lot of the xenophobic rhetoric that the previous administration used, but same sort of thing about kind of focusing on U.S. employment. And, you know, to some extent, that's a little symbolic because most trade is in the private sector. It's not in the government sector. But the danger and the risk there is even if that's good for some sectors and some jobs, it is protectionist policy, right? And as you and I have talked about before, the free trade brings a lot of benefit to consumers. Most people in the U.S. economy experience trade only as consumers, right? And so there have been estimates from the Congressional Research Service about the trade war that we're talking about $1,300 or more raising prices because of tariffs. Buy American raises costs for the U.S. government potentially. If there are cheaper, more efficient producers overseas in our allies or elsewhere that we could buy goods from. So there's kind of this trade-off, as we always have with free trade versus protectionism, is you can kind of serve some goals about employment and jobs and manufacturing in the U.S., but you actually are raising costs because the logic of free trade is the efficiency of free trade drives lower prices, and that increases, you know, social welfare. So you kind of can't have one without the other. And I think that's the delicate dance that Biden is really trying to thread the needle. I think it's too soon to tell. I don't think he's nearly as protectionist as Donald Trump. I don't think he is going to turn out to be an ardent free trader either.
We're talking to Mark Hoplovich right now, professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison, an expert on international trade, looking at how the trade policy of the U.S. might or might not change under President Biden. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think President Biden should do with the existing import tariffs set by President Trump on things like steel, aluminum, agricultural goods? Were you affected by those or by tariffs that came back then from other countries? If you work in a sector that we think about as exporting lots of stuff, dairy here in Wisconsin, for example, or in an industry that relies on imported steel or aluminum, say. What do you think about all this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Mark Koplovich, professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. We're looking at trade issues facing the U.S. and how President Biden is addressing them so far. Key issues to watch out for down the road. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want tariffs put in place by President Trump to stay in place? What do you want to see from the Biden administration on trade with China in particular? How about friendlier countries like the EU and Canada? And are you in or involved in dairy or some kind of steel or aluminum production? How have tariffs affected your life, for better or worse? Soy, for that matter. 800-642-1234. Mark, let's talk about China now. They're in a special category all their own. We are in the stage one still, I think, of the president's negotiations with China to get out of that back and forth tariff war. Where are we? What comes next?
It's too soon to tell, I think. I mean, the trade deal between the U.S. and China was very vague in specifics, right? And it very much reflected Donald Trump's transactional approach to international affairs. He wasn't one for kind of sitting down and negotiating in precise detail exactly what was going to be in the agreement. The focus was very much, I think, on the optics of meeting with China and saying that a deal was struck. So the big centerpiece of it was that China was going to buy a certain amount of U.S. goods by December 31st. And that was going to be used as a benchmark for whether or not the tariffs were going to be withdrawn. The estimates I've seen from Chad Bown and the Peterson Institute in Washington, D.C., who've been tracking this, is that China purchased fewer than half of those goods by December 31st. Now, that agreement was signed before the pandemic hit, right? So you can sort of take those numbers with several grains of salt. But there were not a lot of firm commitments beyond some purchasing targets in that agreement in terms of what China's policies were going to be in the future or not, and not a lot of specifics about what U.S. policy was going to be in the future. So my guess is at some point, the Biden administration is going to try and completely reconfigure the game with China and think about what does an actual serious detailed long-term trade deal look like. But in many ways, I think that the biggest thing you're going to see is that Biden is an internationalist and a transatlanticist and someone who firmly believes in international cooperation and institutions and U.S. leadership in them. Right. And one of the things we saw with the Trump administration was threatening to withdraw from the World Trade Organization. They blocked the appointment of new judges to the court at the WTO to the point that the court basically isn't functional. So a lot of what you've seen so far from Katherine Tai and the Biden administration's releases about what trade policy is going to look like is we're still going to go after China, but we're going to do that by re-engaging with our allies and the institutions where you prosecute and settle disputes between countries, like the World Trade Organization. Right. And I think you actually see that. Katherine Tai, who's going to be the new U.S. trade representative, worked for 7 years during the Obama administration as the chief legal counsel in the prosecution wing of the USTR, which is the wing that was bringing cases against China in the WTO. And she worked subsequently from 2014 onward in the House Ways and Means Committee as the chief trade counsel. She was deeply involved with getting the USMCA agreement with Canada and Mexico, the update to NAFTA, through Congress. And so she has a lot of experience and deeply invested in U.S. engagement with international trade institutions and agreements. And I think that's how you're going to see the Biden administration go after China, right? It's not going to be this bilateral trade war type of perspective. It's going to be, let's get our allies together and really push that China needs to follow the rules in the international trade system.
Talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison about trade policy in the new administration. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ryan is with us in Superior. Ryan, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Ryan?
I believe that your guest is being misleading on one of his previous statements. He had stated that by having international free having a great deal of free trade and a lot of our goods and products coming from overseas, we're essentially bringing down, we're essentially driving down the cost of our product and making it more, bringing more value to American consumers. But there's something misleading about that. If we, it's true that American products and things we make here will be made more expensively, but if we're actually, it's a cycle. We will actually be paying our producers, which are our own citizens, to be industrious and to produce better products. So we're essentially paying ourselves, and we're bringing up our own like standards of a living by doing so.
Ryan, thanks a lot for calling in. Mark, by producing things here, even if we're paying a little more for them, we're keeping that money cycling around in our own economy, Ryan is saying.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point that Ryan brings up, but there is unavoidably a trade-off between those two things, right? So you are creating more American jobs, you may be spurring innovation, but those benefits are concentrated in certain sectors and in the firms and with the people who have those jobs producing those goods. Those benefits are not enjoyed broadly in the way that the benefits of free trade in terms of lower prices, more choice for consumers, things like that. So, and that's the report I talked about earlier, a lot of the estimates about the cost of the trade war, because so many of the goods that consumers do buy, if you go to Walmart, or you go to Target, or you order something on Amazon, they're produced overseas in China or Vietnam or Bangladesh and other places. And if you're producing them at here in the United States, the cost is quite likely going to go up, right? So as I said before, most people experience international trade only through that consumer channel, right? They work in jobs that are not involved in international trade in the local or the regional economy. And so the cost to them of moving away from free trade, they're going to feel that. They're going to feel that only a little on any particular good, but they might feel that over the course of a year in terms of rising prices on all the goods that they purchase. So that's the difficulty with trade. And that's where the politics come in, is there are sectors of the economy and individuals who are certainly going to benefit from bringing jobs back home. And overall, for the U.S., there are also costs that are widely distributed.
Ryan, thanks for the call. Go to John, calling from Door County now. John, hi.
Hello. I'm wondering if the Biden administration has had any discussion about.
Oh, you're cutting out, John. Our producer says you wanted to bring up whether Biden would use economic policy to hold China accountable for human rights violations and even genocide. Mark, how much does human rights issues affect our trade policy, especially with a country like China?
Mm-hmm. I think you will. I'm not sure exactly how yet, right? I think that's that broadening the frame to think more about engaging China on a bunch of issues simultaneously in concert with our allies is the way the Biden administration is going to go, right? And so, again, the way to do that is not to bilaterally try and strike a deal with China. It's to get, the EU, Canada, Mexico, Japan, Australia, India, right? You know, sort of all of the other major players in the global economy to pressure China simultaneously and say, if you don't up labor standards or environmental standards or human rights standards, then we're not going to strike deals with you, right? And there's already some blowback on the EU, which just signed an agreement with a big trade agreement with China. There's already some blowback within the EU that they didn't go far enough on that. So there might be scope for the Biden to kind of reassemble that global coalition. That's a little bit what the Obama administration tried to do with the Trans-Pacific Partnership that the Trump administration withdrew from right at the start in 2017. So I think you're going to see that sort of angle. Right. What that looks like exactly, I'm not sure, because the trade institutions traditionally don't have those sorts of clauses in them. Right. The WTO court is not somewhere where traditionally you can go and say China is breaking the rules because of what's going on in Xinjiang. Right. That's not part of the obligations of being a member of the World Trade Organization. But I could imagine the Biden administration trying to broaden the discussion and basically saying, look, China's not playing not just by trade rules, but they're not playing by a lot of other rules, including human rights rules as well.
And we'll leave it there. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me again.
That's Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs looking at trade and the Biden administration. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Lydia Bastianich is back with us to add some excitement to our pasta dishes. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. A week ago, we talked to a music teacher from Milwaukee with advice on learning a musical instrument for the first time or relearning if you're picking it back up for the first time in a long time. Turns out a lot of people are doing that, with music stores reporting big sales in starter instruments during the pandemic. If you missed the conversation, good news, it's archived at WPR.org. Plus, there's a new write-up with a lot of the advice from our guest also at WPR.org. We heard from some of you in response to that article on Facebook. Tom was referred to us by his friend Janet. Tom says, I'm playing a lot of piano, hacking my way through the first two sections of Moonlight Sonata. And did I say one of my memories of Budapest was seeing Franz Liszt's proudest possession, Beethoven's personal Broadwood piano? Yeah, I've tried to hack my way through Moonlight Sonata. It is harder than it sounds, I'll say. Anne tells us simply, ukulele, and that, our guest said, was a great starter instrument for somebody without even a lot of musical background. So, Ann, you're on target there. And Jerry says, I used Rocksmith for bass guitar. I looked that up. That is a video game, it looks like, one of those games where you get to play along. So check out that article at WPR.org. I don't know if I've practiced saxophone more during the pandemic, but I feel like I practiced better. On the other hand, my drumming career really took a slide. Turns out drums are really loud. And people are around the house a lot more. So bad, loud drumming, not really family friendly. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.